Now, the answer would be possibly yes if the current production process was inefficient, because if we produced our goods and services more efficiently, that would free up some resources that we then could allocate towards increased recycling, for example. Second question, given the state of technical knowledge, assuming efficiency in production, can society hold... So what's different in this line than that line? This line has got and full employment of resources in it. This line doesn't have it. So given the state of technical knowledge and assuming efficiency in production, can society hold production, consumption, and recycling constant and reduce pollution? Well, if there's unemployed resources, yes, because some of those unemployed resources could be used to do what? Convert bad emissions into less bad emissions. So when we say production, consumption, and recycling constant, we're assuming the inputs remain the same. Otherwise, we couldn't keep production and consumption constant and recycling. We're assuming the emissions remain the same. But if there's some unemployed resources still, we still could reduce pollution by taking some of those unemployed resources and using them to turn some of the bad stuff into less bad stuff. So whenever we think about an environmental problem, a pollution problem in this class, we always want to take this materials balance perspective. And we want to think about what would materials balance say about this particular case. And if you think about policy, the government often gets it wrong because they don't take this into account. So people run around and say, we have too much air pollution, so let's pass a law so we have less air pollution. Or let's pass a law saying air pollution has to be reduced through regulations. What does materials balance tell us? If it doesn't go into the air, it's got to do what? It's got to go somewhere, right? So if we reduce air pollution, we're probably going to increase some other type of pollution. Or if we pass a law saying we're going to reduce water pollution and we still have to get rid of the same amount of crap, if you can't put it in the water, you're going to put it somewhere else. Sir.
When people are creating policy like that, I feel like you would think that they would be creating policy saying that you shouldn't pollute the air or you can't pollute the air to a certain extent in an effort to change the production methods. But whether that works or not is another question. But
well, it might be the right thing to do to say we're going to pass a law taxing air pollution, for example. And maybe that's the right thing to do. Now, if we put a tax on air pollution and we don't put a tax on water pollution or solid waste pollution, firms want to do what? They have emissions, and they always want to get rid of their emissions in the what? The least cost way. So if you increase the cost of getting rid of the stuff one way, they're going to switch to getting rid of it the other way. Now, if the people who came up with this tax took into account materials balance and said, okay, we understand that increasing the tax on air pollution is going to increase water pollution, and they took that into account and said it's the right thing to do, given that, because water pollution isn't as bad for us as air pollution, for example, fine. But a lot of us has this sense that we can sort of get rid of air pollution and it goes into an antimatter machine or something and it disappears, right? And if you think about it that way, you're often going to make a mistake. Because you're not... The big picture is we have to take account of the general equilibrium implications of what it is we're doing. And if you don't understand materials balance, then a lot of environmental policy is going to have what? Unintended consequences. And you could end up with a situation that's worse than when you started. Maybe not, but you could. Okay, so much for materials balance. Moving along here. What is wrong with this thing? So, why do we have a course in environmental economics? I was arguing the other day that from an efficiency point of view and an allocation of resources point of view, it doesn't make any sense to sort of think about one particular resource in isolation of other resources. Like, you know, we have courses in this department, labor economics. Well, there's many different kinds of resources, and labor just happens to be one of them. So, does it make any sense to just think about how labor should be allocated independent of capital, or land, or water, or energy? And on some sense, some level, the answer is probably no. Sir? You could or you couldn't?
I would say you couldn't. At least have it make sense.
Well, wait a sec. But now aren't you arguing that you shouldn't have a course where you just look at one resource?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were saying that it did make sense to look at just one.
I'm saying that you can't have a course where you put all resources into one topic. I think it's good that you have labor economics and then you have environmental economics. Because things like the environment are very different than humans and capital.
Okay. Well, you're an economist, right? There's a theory about how resources should be utilized, right? Why do you give a shit whether it's natural or unnatural or created by people or created by trees? Is the theory different?
Technically, no.
Right. But if we have humans here, let's say labor and capital, and we want to produce ten widgets, what do we call this curve here?
Isoquant.
Iso as in one quantity. Along the curve, we're holding output constant, right? So this curve is suggesting what? It's suggesting that we could produce 10 widgets with that much capital and that much labor, or that much capital and that much labor. In other words, it suggests what? That resources substitute for one another, right? Ma'am.
Well, in the review question, has your natural resources and other resources. So you have to have environmental economics because our natural resources, a lot of them we can't reproduce and recreate. So we only have so many of them. So we have to look at, okay, we only have this many. What can we substitute potentially for these ones, so we have to figure out the balance.
So you're kind of saying there's something special about natural and environmental resources,
yeah.
And one of the things is that some of them aren't renewable?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Some are renewable, though,
yeah.
Right? Is that your argument, too, that there's something special about people as compared to trucks?
What she said makes a lot of sense. Because you can always get a new machine, or at least until you run out of iron or whatever. But at this current rate, there's not going to be fresh water for hundreds more years. But it seems like there will be for metal. For humans, definitely. I don't think we're just going to go extinct in the next 100 years.
We let's say copper is an input into the production of things. Copper is something we produce, right? We dig holes in the ground, we take a bunch of ore out, we smelt it, that takes all kinds of energy, blah, blah, blah. So we produce copper. Now, where do babies come from? They're also produced, right? Using a bunch of energy and inputs and all. So we produce copper wire, we produce babies. So far, any difference?
Well, yeah, one's finite, one's not.
Which one's finite?
I would say technically the copper, but I guess if human race stopped, they would be finite as well.
Okay, so let's make the example more comparable. Corn and babies, okay? They're both renewable, right? Corn is an input into the production of things. Labor, people's time, is an input into the production of things, right? So they're both produced through a biological... Is corn production biological? Yeah, it's got a...
It's life.
It's life, right? Corn's alive, at least until you...
Eat it.
So when the kernels, after you've chomped on the kernels and they're in your stomach, but you haven't digested them yet, are they still alive, going, help me, that kind of stuff? I don't... So, why as economists might we draw a distinction between the corn and babies when we think about the allocation of resources? Last time we talked a lot about who's a member of society and who's not, right? And as an economist, you probably think of people as being members of society, but you probably don't think of corn as being members of society. So maybe one reason we have a course in labor economics is because it's a particular input that's both a resource and a what? And a member of society. Unlike corn. Now, bears in the woods, maybe somewhere in between, right?
We don't have bear economics.
We don't have people economics. There's no reason we can't make bears members of society. We go over to our environmental studies, there's all kinds of people who would say, bears have every right just as much as you. You probably know some bears you like better than some people you know, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, bears are pretty predictable. You know, one of the problems with economics is we're always trying to estimate the preferences of people, the preferences of members of society, right? I could go get Sophie out of my office, my dog, and whose preferences do you think are easier to measure, yours or the dog's?
Hers,
right? She's pretty predictable, right? I can tell you kind of exactly what she likes and what she doesn't like, right? You're a harder call, right?
That's true.
You might even lie to me about your preferences. She probably is not going to lie to me about her preferences, right? So, you know, as we said last time, I really want you guys to get your arms around this idea of the possibility that society could consist of individuals that aren't humans. And I want you to do that for two reasons. One of the reasons is not because I want you to conclude that bears are members of society, right? You can if you want. But I want you to realize that who's included in society and who's not included in society varies across people. Who you think should be included, it might be different than who I think should be included. You know, you might exclude the Israelis. Or people who live in Broomfield.
That's more so, yeah.
Okay, so you would exclude people who live in Broomfield, right? Does anybody here live in Broomfield? And do you feel excluded now? Right. But what we want to do has a big impact on who we include, who we don't include. And there's no right answer that says bears shouldn't be members of society. There's not an economic answer to that question, right? Just like there's no... economic answer to should you be versus him. And the point is, though, what you need to see is that other people don't think of it the same way economists do, and the implication, what the hell we should do with bears, depends a lot on what? Whether they're members of society or not. If members of society like to shoot bears, and bears aren't members of society, then shooting bears is efficiency increasing. If you make bears members of society, Maybe not, right? Shooting members of a certain ethnic group. Is efficiency increasing if we like to shoot them and they're not members of society? Now, people in that ethnic group might disagree with you about who
should...
Probably, right. Okay. So a lot of the differences, when people look at the environment, a lot of the differences come down to who you include, whose preferences count, and whose preferences don't count. Or even more generally, should rocks count or not? Yeah. How do we apply the class to what?
To like looking at the general population.
General population of what?
Exactly. Like if everyone has a different perspective, then how do you apply it?
Well, as an economist, we might say the following. We might say that if the only members of society are people who are currently living in Boulder, the correct environmental policy or the efficient thing to do might be very different than if society consists of people who live in Boulder and in Denmark. Mm-hmm. So we just say, given who's in society, given who counts, what should we do?
But I mean like on the like a wider scale, like Boulder is obviously like a specific
place,
demographic.
Right.
But if you're looking at, let's say, the United States,
right,
there's different perspectives, like even from one coast to another. You know, so how would you apply it in terms of the United States?
Well, if I work for the federal government, right, and they ask me to try and figure out whether a policy is efficiency increasing or not, my inclination will be to think of society as being what? The population of the United citizens of the U.S., mm-hmm. right? If I'm hired by the city of Boulder to figure out how to efficiently allocate open space in Boulder, the implicit assumption is probably what? Society consists of residents of Boulder, and the Boulder City Council wants to do what's best for...
Yeah.
So we're not in the business of deciding who's in the game and who's not in the game. We're in the business of figuring out what's efficiency increasing, for example, if population is defined this way versus if it's defined that way.
Okay.
And if you're fighting with somebody about what we should do about the environment, right, often it will come down to you and that other person are using the exact same logic and arguments, but what might be different in their mind than in your mind is how they're defining society.
Mm-hmm.
Like they might be putting more weight on future generations than you. So the only reason they want to do something about global warming and you don't is because you're defining society differently. And we just need to recognize that. So if we're looking at an environmental argument and we're trying to identify why is your conclusion different than her conclusion, is what are you assuming that's different? And often what it comes down to is who counts and who doesn't count. And how they count. Okay, so I guess we have to have a course in labor economics or human resource economics. That's another one where labor economics is kind of the same thing, sort of. Because there's something special about labor. You were arguing what earlier? There's something special about environmental resources.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's special about them?
Well, I was arguing that the ones that we can't substitute for or the ones we can't reproduce, because when we're out of it, we're out of it. So for now, we need to figure out how to make it last as long as we can, or how much of or how little of one we can of them we can use to still create or produce the amount we want.
Okay, so let's make a distinction between renewable and non-renewable. Renewable basically means it's got a positive biological growth rate. Non-renewable, it doesn't have a I mean, even oil is renewable. You know, trees fall down, rocks get on top, millions of years go by, it compresses the rocks, you know, turns it into oil, right? But it takes a hell of a long time.
Yeah.
So we think of oil in the ground, crude oil, as having a zero, it's not renewable, right? So you're saying there's something about certain resources that make them special because they're not renewable. Meaning, and where'd you go from there? You said, because if there's only a certain amount of them, once we use it all up, it's gone.
And if we need those to produce things, then we can't produce the things that we need them to use.
Okay. So if we went over to engineering, he's retired now, and we talked to L. Bartlett. We should watch him sometime. So L. Bartlett would tell us that, yes, there's these non-renewable resources, and we're using them up at a very fast rate, and we're going to run out of them, and they're essential inputs into production, so the shit's going to hit the fan, right? So let me generalize what you're saying. I think it's a good point, and that's that because resources, certain types of natural resources are non-renewable, if we think of something as non-renewable and we think of it as an essential input into the production of things we really want, then we sort of reach the conclusion if we run out of it, we're going to be up shit crick. So maybe we better be concerned about how we're using this, right? So maybe we're, that's part of a more general argument that says what though? That maybe we're not using, we're worried because maybe we're not using these resources correctly and we're going to get in big trouble in the future because we're not. Fair enough. Let's see what I said. Oh, you know what I said? I said I didn't plug it in. You know, I do this all the time. My power cord is sitting over in Chem 140. So in some theoretical sense, a resource is a resource. So you could argue on one hand that it doesn't make sense. We can't talk about how to allocate labor. If you can use labor and capital to produce something, it doesn't make sense to talk about how much labor we should use independently of how much capital we should use if things substitute for one another. Now, if they don't substitute for one another, if you have something that doesn't substitute for anything else, so to produce one widget takes 1 pound of this crap no matter what, that would be more of an argument, I think, for thinking about it independently of other stuff. The reason I think we have a course in this is because there's interest. A lot of people are concerned about the environment and natural resources. A lot of people think that they're misallocated. Yeah. Global warming is happening too quickly. Or we have too much air pollution, or species are going extinct, or whatever. So a lot of people, I think, are particularly worried, more worried about the allocation of natural resources as environmental resources than they are worried about trucks and how trucks are allocated, or machines to make bowling balls. So maybe somehow we think the market's not doing a very good job. Or, on the other hand, the government's got their fingers in it, and the government is screwing up the allocation of natural resources. So, I just sort of came up with a list here of environmental concerns, okay? Going back to L. Bartlett here, in 1972, there was this famous book, Limits to Growth, right? And Limits to Growth got everybody all excited about growth, and how growth was going to be limited by natural resources. And when this book came out, I remember, according to this book, we ran out of oil in 1986. What?
I was just going to say that there's a really good 30-year update to that book. But I thought Daniela Menendez was the author of that book, not Albert Moldauer.
No, no, no. Limits to Growth was written by a group of people called the Club of Rome, of which I think he was one of that group. Okay. The idea was that we've only got so many pounds of this crap in the ground. It's an essential input into production. So basically, the book assumed, like, isoquants don't look like this. They assume they look like this. So let's call this labor and capital here. And let's call it natural resources here. And the idea was they assume production functions look like this, Leontief. So if you're going to make 10 widgets, you had to have this much natural resources. So if the natural resource stock fell below this amount here, let's call it 5, you wouldn't be able to produce 10 widgets. So they make two arguments. One, that resources are finite. And the other argument was that natural resources in production have to be used in fixed proportions. We can't substitute away from natural resources and produce the same thing only using, say, labor and capital. There's some essential amount of natural resources. Then the idea is, well, once we fall below that essential amount, production and consumption has to go down. And it'll just keep going down and down and down. So if we don't stop this process, the shit's going to hit the fan. So if you click here, you can watch L. Bartlett on YouTube. Unfortunately, you can't watch Thomas Malthus. So just what I did here, I drew an isoquant. What it looks like is really important. So if I drew an isoquant that looked like this, for example, let's say that's the isoquant for 10 widgets, labor and capital, natural resources here. If that's the isoquant, would you rather live in a world like this or like this? Why like that? It says you can do what?
Because you can use a lot of labor and capital and very few natural resources and get the same amount of output.
Yeah, I mean, if it hits the line here, you can actually produce the 10 widgets using no natural resources. This would be an example where you can always substitute away from natural resources. Here, once you get to here, substitution becomes, well, here there's no substitution. But we could think about intermediate cases that look like where in some range they can substitute, but then outside of that range they can't substitute. I don't want to get into all this at the moment, but the point is that when you think about why people get excited about natural resources and environmental resources, a lot of people worry about this. I think fewer people now than maybe 30 years ago, but still, there's lots of people like L. Bartlett who think the shit's going to hit the fan. And you might say, well, the shit hasn't hit the fan yet. But the fact that it hasn't hit the fan yet doesn't mean it's not going to hit the fan. It's like if you jump out off the Empire State Building. So 2 seconds have gone by and you haven't hit the ground yet. That doesn't mean you're fine, right? There's lots of concern about non-catastrophic pollution. And why is that? Non-catastrophic pollution, by that I mean things like not a nuclear bomb or something, right? Like more particulates in the air. So a lot of people think there's too much air pollution or too much water pollution. The water's not clean enough. The air's not clean enough. Why do we care about the environment? Why do we care about pollution? Well, it depends on who you are, but why might someone care about it? Sir?
Health.
Health. You're worried that it's going to have a delirious effect. What's that word? Deleterious? No, what? Whatever. You're worried that it's going to make you unhealthy.
Well, personally, I have lung problems, so more particles in the air is worse for me.
Okay. So if you're particularly susceptible to particles in the air, then you're going to get more excited about it, right? Do we care more about it now than we did in the past?
We know more about it now than we did in the past.
So maybe we care about it more now because we understand that it might hurt us, so we have better information about the link between particulates in our lungs and lung disease, right? Okay, fair enough. Is there any other reason why we might care more about it now than, say, people did in the past? Sir? Well, we're talking about non-catastrophic pollution now. So we're not talking about things like, think about like more shit in the water, right? More sewage, more particulates in the air, that kind of stuff. Why might we care more now than we did before? Okay, again, you're talking about global warming, right? Think about water pollution.
Maybe just education.
So we better understand the link between disease and goobers in the water, right? Okay, so that's one thing. So let's think about... I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Quality of life, possibly.
What do you mean by the quality of life?
That... we have a higher standard for what our life should be compared to back in the day, and I guess it...
So why do we have a higher... So what he's saying is maybe we're more concerned about air pollution now than we were in the past. What's one reason we might be more concerned about air pollution now than we were in the past? Sir?
It's happening much more rapidly now.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. Maybe.
We can see like the compound effects of all of it.
Yeah, but we're just back to his education argument. We understand better.
Well, not even that, just visually. Like 100 years ago, I'm sure there was like a building in LA and you didn't have a giant black cloud over it, and now you can visibly see that. And people have started to ask, yeah, it comes down to education, but still, like, whether you're an idiot or not, you can look at that and be like, what's that? Why is that there? You know what I'm saying?
Let's go back. Let's go back to London, for example. Let's say 400 years ago. Okay. And what was flowing down the middle of the street? Shit. Dead animals rotting at the corner. I mean, people didn't see all that stuff.
I mean, that's like, well.
What's he getting to? We can afford to worry about it, right? If you're worried about whether your kid's going to starve tomorrow or not, you're not going to worry about whether you're going to get lung disease in 30 years, right? As your standard of living, as he points out, as we get richer, right, our marginal rate of substitution between a cleaner environment and consumer goods changes. When you're really poor, your willingness to pay for cleaner air, say in terms of reduced food, is what? Very low. Because you'd starve to death. You're not willing to give up much of your food at all to get cleaner air in 20 years or to save pandas from extinction or whatever. But as you get rich, your willingness to pay a clean environment is a luxury good. It's a superior good. As income goes up, our demand for it goes up relative to other commodities.
Well, I was going to say, like, back then, they didn't have any solution to, like, where to put all the feces and all that stuff. And so as we've gotten richer and we've, again, the education part, we've solved all those problems. So a lot of the problems that they were dealing with then, we don't have... to deal with this as much because we've figured it out. So now we're moving on to problems that they would have never thought of just because they were focused on other things.
So the idea being that the state of technology has changed for sewage treatment?
Or just things in general?
I mean, we know a lot of stuff now. We know how to do a lot of stuff that we didn't know how to do back then. Mm-hmm. And I agree that things have changed because we figured out new ways to treat sewage, for example. So I don't disagree with that. But why is it that we're using our knowledge and our resources to clean up, say, air pollution and water pollution more so than we did in the past? Why is it different? The technology in India, the state of knowledge for cleaning up water pollution in India is the same state of knowledge for cleaning up water pollution here. Why is there more water pollution there than here? We're richer. I'm not saying more people doesn't count too, but what I want to concentrate on for just this moment is that it's a luxury good. It's a superior good. I don't mean luxury in a normative sense. I mean it's a superior good in the sense that as your income goes up, your demand for a clean environment, for species preservation, for all that kind of stuff goes up at a faster rate than your income is going up. Poor people in the developing world, their willingness to pay to reduce their risk of getting cancer in 30 years is pretty what? Low. They only wish they could last 30 more years to have the chance of getting the cancer. We can afford to worry about these things. And I'm not saying that's the only factor, but that's a really important factor. If we think about elephant preservation, people in Boulder probably have a much higher willingness to pay to preserve elephants than people who live in Africa with those elephants. One reason for that is the more money you have, the more willingness to pay you have. Rich people have more willingness to pay than poor people. And if it's something that rich people care about, and they're rich, they're going to do more about it. If you took just you and we kept your preference for the environment the same, but we made you poor, or a lot poorer, you'd be willing to allocate less of your scarce resources to cleaning up the environment. Let's go back to our London example. Is London now more or less polluted than it was 300 years ago? Less? More? Again, it depends on how we define pollution, but if we think of pollution as something that makes people sick and kills people, way more people back then died of pollution than people, and they died more quickly, in a matter of days or whatever, influenza, malaria, all kinds of stuff, than people do now. Now, you could also say, well, the mix of pollutants has changed. We have less sewage flowing down the street, but maybe we have more toxic chemicals. But if you had a choice between the sewage flowing down the middle of the street or the toxic chemicals in low concentrations, you might go for the toxic chemicals in low concentrations. Now, on the one hand, we'd say from a materials balance point of view, we would expect what? Way more pollution in London now? Or less? Way, way more, right? Because the average person in London now consumes way more stuff than the average person in London 300 years ago. So if we think about it just in terms of materials balance, you'd say we're taking way more stuff out of the environment, way more stuff has to go back into the environment, emissions must be going up, but if emissions are going up, how can it be and why can it be that it's less polluted than it was back then when we were producing and consuming so much less stuff? As the standard of living increases, our tolerance for pollution decreases. Why is it doing that? I better look at all these notes. It's going to shut me down in a second here. So we mentioned increasing information, willingness to pay, you know, it being a luxury good, that sort of thing. So we're getting more concerned because we're getting richer, right? Now, one thing we have now, also, a lot of people are concerned about what we might call catastrophic pollution. So what would be an example of catastrophic pollution? Nukes, right? Something that can kill thousands or millions of people in a very short period of time. Could be some sort of virus, I guess, too. Pardon? Yeah, chemical weapons, that sort of thing. At least it's catastrophic in the neighborhood, right? Is global warming, is that catastrophic? Could be, right? Could be. Or maybe global warming's good. You know, it's nice outside, it's not snowing. You can get a suntan, pool's still open, that sort of thing. Some people are concerned that we're going to poison our planet in a way that's drastically going to change or end life as we know it. So all we're trying to do right now is not argue good or bad or anything. We're just saying, well, why do people care about the environment? And some people care because they think we might be doing something to the environment that's going to basically wreck the place as a place for people to live. And only the cockroaches will be running around or whatever. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but global warming, loss of the ozone layer, I think it gets a lot of people excited. What are some other concerns that people have about the environment? The preservation of natural environments. If you think about groups like the Sierra Club or Friends of the Earth, they think we're deteriorating or extincting our natural areas at too fast of a rate. They think we should be saving things, conserving things, I don't mean specific animals now, but ecosystems, and we're not. So somehow the market or whatever is screwing up, and we're using up the rainforest too quickly, the Arctic, national parks, that sort of thing. Now, at a smaller level of that, I mean, there's lots of people who are concerned about particular species that, you know, this species is going extinct if we don't do something because of market forces or whatever, and we don't like that. We're concerned that it's going extinct. Why is that happening? Should it be happening? How would we stop it from happening? You know, what is the optimal population stock? Now, the one I like the best is one of my former students, it was her view, she's a law student now, that the current concern for the environment is simply because of a portion of the population always needs to be catastrophic about something, right? And the environment collapse is the current groovy candidate. And specifically, if you're really into that, you'll get to have lunch with Al Gore and you'll get to meet celebrities and movie stars and all that kind of stuff. So her view was just that we always have to run around worrying about something and the environment is just the current worry. So as long as it's the current worry, people will take this class and I'll get to teach this class, but if you guys move on, your kids move on to something else to worry about, maybe we won't care about the environment. Okay. So why all this concern? As an economist, we'd say a lot of people think the allocation of natural and environmental resources is screwed up. Like, if we thought the system was doing a perfect job of allocating environmental resources and natural resources, there's really nothing to do from a policy point of view, and why don't we worry about something that's misallocated? A lot of us must worry that environmental and natural resources are misallocated. The allocation is screwed up. So what do we mean by screwed up? Well, it depends on who you ask, but if you ask an economist, what would an economist say?
Not efficient.
They're not being allocated efficiently, or they're not being allocated what? What's the other E word?
Equitably.
Equitably, right? So how do economists judge good from bad? Typically, we judge on the criteria of efficiency, and we judge on the criteria of fairness. So an economist might phrase this argument that they say, well, a lot of people think, or for one reason or another, a lot of people, maybe a lot of economists, suspect that the allocation of environmental or natural resources is inefficient. If it is inefficient, then that raises the question, why? So there's a bunch of people who say it's inefficient because the market is screwing up. The market is misallocating our resources. And then there's a bunch of other people who say what? It's the goddamn government. If you let the market do it, the market would do a good job of allocating our resources. But the government gets involved, and things are inefficient because the government has screwed it all up. You're agreeing or disagreeing with one of those, or both of them, or what? Or both the market and the government are screwing it up, right? Yeah, I mean, some people would say, well, the market's screwing it up, and then the government tries to fix it, and they screw it up even worse. Yeah, that's an opinion, right? So if we're going to talk about screwed up and misallocations in terms of efficiency and equity, what should we do at this point? I guess we should define them, right? So let's pretend we're having a quiz. So take a piece of paper. Pull out other things so you can hand it to me afterwards. Write somebody's name at the top. Hopefully somebody who's in this class. Okay. It'd be nice if you wrote your own name. But you might not want to reveal. You might not want to take credit for your answer, right?
This isn't like an attendance thing.
It's not like an attendance thing?
You put our name on it, and you take attendance.
My goal here is not to take attendance, okay? My goal is to see how you define the word efficiency. So an allocation of resources is efficient if... And then if you really want to go wild, you could have another one that says an allocation of resources is inefficient if. You all done? May I have it? Done? No, no, you're just defining efficiency. Anybody else want to give me one? So everyone else has given me a full piece of paper that I can put in a nice little stack like this. And then
now mine can just go on top.
Maybe I can use yours as like the rubber band to wrap around all the others?
That's fine.
Hey, what should I do with these? Okay. Anybody got a red pen? An allocation of resources is efficient if the most possible members in society are benefited with a minimum amount of members of society being harmed. So the idea there, they're saying that if we benefit the most number of people, if an action benefits, the more people it benefits, the more efficient it is, and the fewer people it harms, the more efficient it is. Is that how I should read that? Allocation of resources is efficient if the marginal benefits of using the X amount of resources is higher than the marginal cost. The X amount of the resources. Now, normally when we talk about marginal, we talk about a little bit more of it or a little bit less of it. But here we're just saying, are we just saying it's efficient if the benefits of using it are greater than the costs of using it? Is that how we're defining it? See, now everybody also knows who you are, right? Because you've got... But you see, he knew his answer was right, so that's why he wanted it to be distinct. He wanted it to be obvious it was him. Allocation of resources is efficient if all of it is being used entirely and among different things. So that says what? The allocation of resources is efficient if we're using all of them to produce different things. The allocation of resources is efficient if the total benefits to society is maximized while having the total cost to society minimized. An allocation of resources is efficient if all the parties that need the resource are allocated the same amount so that no one group suffers any more than another. Equal benefits from the resource to all parties involved. So let's start with inefficient. An allocation of resources is inefficient if what? If we can reallocate the resources in such a way that we can make at least one member of society better off without making any other member of society worse off, then the current allocation is inefficient. Okay. What's the difference between what I just said and what she said? She said one what? If you can make one person better off without making any other persons worse off, then the current allocation is inefficient. How is that different than my definition? I said members of society. So implicit in her definition was society consists of people, right? My definition was more general than that, right? So what would efficient be? If we can change the allocation of resources in such a way that after the change, some members of society are better off and no other members of society are worse off. I just said that wrong, didn't I? The allocation is efficient if the only way we can reallocate to make some members of society better off, underline, 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 requires that other members be made worse off. So when we get to a situation where the only way we can make some of us better off requires that other members of society be made worse off, then the allocation is efficient from society's perspective. There's no free lunch left. If things are inefficient, we could make them better off. We could rearrange things and make them better off without making any of the rest of us worse off. So if we don't do that, things are inefficient. But once we get rid of all those potentials, then we've achieved efficiency. Now, let's think about how that relates to some of the things we've said here. If things are efficient, does that mean we're doing what's best for society? No, not necessarily. Why? Yeah, so we can imagine a situation where society just consists of the two of us. And let's say we both like to drink aquavit. You guys know what aquavit is? People who are from Scandinavian countries drink this stuff called aquavit. And it's this clear liquor that the taste is caraway, right? I don't know what you call it in Danish, but it's basically, it has a caraway kind of taste to it, right? It's kind of an acquired taste. But let's say we've got one case of aquavit. That's all we got. And currently, we both like aquavit too. The more, the better, right? So the more aquavit I have, the better off I am, and the more aquavit she has, the better off she is. But let's assume it's not a public good. We can't drink the same aquavit at the same time, right? Like she can't sort of swish it around her mouth and then spit it into my mouth or something. So we'll assume that away, right? So the more aquavit she has to drink, the better off she is, but the less there is for me to drink. So let's start off with a situation where she has all the aquavit and I have none. Is that an efficient allocation of aquavit? Yes. Can we make anyone better off without making anyone worse off in that case? The only way to make me better off is to do what? Take some aquavit away from her, right? So we're in a situation where the only way to make me better off requires that she's made worse off. Or if I have all the aquavit and she has none, Is that efficient? Yes, because the only way to make her better off is to make me worse off. What if it's split 50-50? Again, that's efficient too. Every allocation of the aquavit is efficient because we're in a situation where the only way to make one of us better off requires that the other is made worse off. Now, what if she doesn't like aquavit? We got a bunch of aquavit. She's got it all. I don't have any. I like the stuff. She doesn't like it. Is the allocation of aquavit efficient? No. Because why? Because she could give it to me, and it would make me better off, and she doesn't care about the aquavit, so she's no worse off by giving it to me, so I'm better off and she's no worse off. So that would be an inefficient allocation. And in that case, the only efficient allocation of aquavit would be what? I get it all, right? She doesn't care about it. The more I have, the better off I am. She doesn't give a shit about aquavit either way, so the efficient allocation would be give it all to me if we're only the two members of society. So what if we're talking about food rather than aquavit? And I've got it all, she's got none, and we both like food. Is that efficient? Probably. Now, you might object to that, though. You might say it's not what?
Equitable
or fair, right? So there might be lots of different efficient allocations, but we might not like some of them because we think of them as being very what? Unfair. Is there anything about efficiency that suggests we should have equal treatment of people? No. Sir. No, he was supposed to remind me.
You.
Okay, find your group.